Chapter 125. Phil Squad and Joe are sent out immediately on this work of improvement. Miss Flight, quite enraptured by her success, makes the best of her way to court, having great fears that otherwise her friend the Chancellor may be uneasy about her, or may give the judgment she has so long expected in her absence, and observing which you know, my dear physician, and general, after so many years, would be too absurdly unfortunate. Alan takes the opportunity of going out to procure some restorative medicines, and obtaining them near at hand, soon returns to find the trooper walking up and down the gallery, and to fall into step and walk with him. I take it, sir, says Mr. George, that you know Miss Summerson pretty well?
Yes, it appears.
Not related to her, sir?
No, it appears.
Excuse the apparent curiosity, says Mr. George. It seemed to me probable that you might take more than a common interest in this poor creature, because Miss Summerson had taken that unfortunate interest in him.
'Tis my case, sir, I assure you.
And mine, Mr. George. The trooper looks sideways at Alan's sunburnt cheek and bright dark eye, rapidly measures his height and build, and seems to approve of him.
Since you have been out, sir, I have been thinking that I unquestionably know the rooms in Lincoln's Inn Fields, where Bucket took the lad, according to his account. Though he is not acquainted with the name, I can help you to it.
It's Tulkinghorn.
That's what it is.
Alan looks at him inquiringly, repeating the name.
Tulkinghorn.
That's the name, sir.
I know the man, and know him to have been in communication with Bucket before, respecting a deceased person who had given him offense.
I know the man, sir,
to my sorrow.
Alan naturally asks what kind of man he is.
What kind of man?
Do you mean to look at?
I think I know that much of him.
I mean to deal with.
Generally, what kind of man?
Why, then I'll tell you, sir, returns the trooper, stopping short and folding his arms on his square chest so angrily that his face fires and flushes all over. He is a confoundedly bad kind of man. He is a slow torturing kind of man. He is no more like flesh and blood than a rusty old carbon is. He is a kind of man, by George, that has caused me more restlessness and more uneasiness, and more dissatisfaction with myself than all other men put together.
That's the kind of man Mr. Tulkinghorn is.
I am sorry, says Alan, to have touched so sore a place.
Sore?
The trooper plants his legs wider apart, wets the palm of his broad right hand, and lays it on the imaginary mustache.
It's no fault of yours, sir, but you shall judge.
He has got a power over me. He is the man I spoke of just now as being able to tumble me out of this place neck and crop. He keeps me on a constant seesaw. He won't hold off, and he won't come on. If I have a payment to make him, or time to ask him for, or anything to go to him about, he don't see me, don't hear me, passes me on to Melchizedek's in Clifford's Inn. Melchizedek's in Clifford's Inn passes me back again to him. He keeps me prowling and dangling about him, as if I was made of the same stone as himself.
Why, I spend half my life now, pretty well, loitering and dodging about his door.
What does he care?
Nothing.
Just as much as the rusty old carbon I have compared him to. He chafes and goads me till bah.
Nonsense.
I am forgetting myself.
Mr. Woodcourt, the trooper resumes his march. All I say is, he is an old man, but I am glad I shall never have the chance of setting spurs to my horse and riding at him in a fair field. For if I had that chance, in one of the humors he drives me into, he'd go down, sir.
Mr. George has been so excited that he finds it necessary to wipe his forehead on his shirt sleeve. Even while he whistles his impetuosity away with the national anthem, some involuntary shakings of his head and heavings of his chest still linger behind, not to mention an occasional hasty adjustment with both hands of his open shirt collar, as if it were scarcely open enough, to prevent his being troubled by a choking sensation.
In short, Alan Woodcourt has not much doubt about the going down of Mr. Tulkinghorn on the field referred to. Joe and his conductor presently return, and Joe is assisted to his mattress by the careful Phil, to whom, after due administration of medicine by his own hands, Alan confides all needful means and instructions. The morning is by this time getting on apace. He repairs to his lodgings to dress and breakfast, and then, without seeking rest, goes away to Mr. Jarndyce to communicate his discovery. With him Mr. Jarndyce returns alone, confidentially telling him that there are reasons for keeping this matter very quiet indeed, and showing a serious interest in it. To Mr. Jarndyce, Joe repeats in substance what he said in the morning, without any material variation. Only that card of his is heavier to draw, and draws with a hollower sound. Let me lay here quiet, and not be chivied no more, falters Joe, and be so kind any person as is a passin' nigh, where I used fur to sleep, as just to say to Mr. Sangsby that Joe, what he known once, is a moving on right forwards with his duty, and I'll be worry thankful. I'd be more thankful than I am arity, if it was any ways possible for an unfortunate to be it. He makes so many of these references to the lost stationer in the course of a day or two that Alan, after conferring with Mr. Jarndyce, good-naturedly resolves to call in Cook's Court, the rather, as the cart seems to be breaking down. To Cook's Court, therefore, he repairs. Mr. Snagsby is behind his counter in his grey coat and sleeves, inspecting an indenture of several skins which has just come in from the engrosser's, an immense desert of law hand and parchment, with here and there a resting place of a few large letters, to break the awful monotony, and save the traveller from despair. Mr. Snagsby puts up at one of these inky wells, and greets the stranger with his cough of general preparation for business. You don't remember me, Mr. Snagsby? The stationer's heart begins to thump heavily, for his old apprehensions have never abated. It is as much as he can do to answer, no, sir, I can't say I do. I should have considered not to put too fine a point upon it, that I never saw you before, sir. Twice before, says Alan Woodcourt. Once at a poor bedside, and once, it's come at last. Thinks the afflicted stationer, as recollection breaks upon him. It's got to a head now, and is going to burst. But he has sufficient presence of mind to conduct his visitor into the little counting house, and to shut the door. Are you a married man, sir? No, I am not. Would you make the attempt, though single, says Mr. Snagsby in a melancholy whisper, to speak as low as you can? For my little woman is a listening somewheres, or I'll forfeit the business and £500. In deep dejection Mr. Snagsby sits down on his stool, with his back against his desk, protesting, I never had a secret of my own, sir. I can't charge my memory with ever having once attempted to deceive my little woman on my own account, since she named the day. I wouldn't have done it, sir. Not to put too fine a point upon it, I couldn't have done it, I durstn't have done it. Whereas, and nevertheless, I find myself wrapped round with secrecy and mystery, till my life is a burden to me. His visitor professes his regret to bear it, and asks him does he remember Joe. Mr. Snagsby answers with a suppressed groan, oh, don't he? You couldn't name an individual human being except myself, that my little woman is more set and determined against than Joe, says Mr. Snagsby. Alan asks why. Why? Repeats Mr. Snagsby, in his desperation clutching at the clump of hair at the back of his bald head. How should one know why? But you are a single person, sir, and may you long be spared to ask a married person such a question. With this beneficent wish, Mr. Snagsby coughs a cough of dismal resignation, and submits himself to hear what the visitor has to communicate. There again, says Mr. Snagsby, who, between the earnestness of his feelings, and the suppressed tones of his voice, is discolored in the face. At it again, in a new direction. A certain person charges me, in the solemnest way, not to talk of Joe to anyone, even my little woman. Then comes another certain person, in the person of yourself, and charges me, in an equally solemn way, not to mention Joe to that other certain person above all other persons. Why, this is a private asylum. Why, not to put too fine a point upon it, this is bedlam, sir, says Mr. Snagsby. But it is better than he expected after all, being no explosion of the mind below him, or deepening of the pit into which he has fallen. And being tender-hearted and affected by the account he hears of Joe's condition, he readily engages to look round as early in the evening as he can manage it quietly. He looks round very quietly when the evening comes, but it may turn out that Mrs. Snagsby is as quiet a manager as he. Joe is very glad to see his old friend and says, when they are left alone, that he takes it uncommon kind as Mr. Snagsby should come so far out of his way on accounts of sich as him. Mr. Snagsby, touched by the spectacle before him, immediately lays upon the table half a crown, that magic balsam of his for all kinds of wounds. And how do you find yourself, my poor lad? Inquires the stationer with his cough of sympathy. I am in luck, Mr. Snagsby, I am, returns Joe, and don't want for nothing. I'm more comfler nor you can think. Mr. Snagsby, I'm worry sorry that I done it, but I didn't go fur to do it, sir. The stationer softly lays down another half crown, and asks him what it is that he is sorry for having done. Mr. Snagsby, says Joe, I went and give a illness to the lady as woes, and it as warned the t'other lady, and none of them never says nothing to me for having done it, on accounts of their being sir good and my having been sin fortunate. The lady come herself, and see me yesterday, and she says, ah, Joe, she says, we thought we'd lost you, Joe, she says. And she sits down a smillin' so quiet, and don't pass a word nor yet a look upon me for having done it, she don't, and I turns agin the wall, I do's, Mr. Snagsby, and Mr. Jarnders, I see him a forced to turn away his own self. And Mr. Woodcott, he come fur to give me something fur to ease me, what he's allus a doin' on day and night, and when he come a bending over me, and a speakin' up so bold, I see his tears a fallin', Mr. Snagsby. The softened stationer deposits another half crown on the table. Nothing less than a repetition of that infallible remedy will relieve his feelings. What I was a thinkin' on, Mr. Snagsby, proceeds Joe, woes, as he was able to write worry large, perhaps? Yes, Joe, please God, returns the stationer. Uncommon precious large, perhaps? Says Joe with eagerness. Yes, my poor boy. Joe laughs with pleasure. What I was a thinking on then, Mr. Snagsby, was, that when I was moved on as fur as ever I could go, and couldn't be moved no further, whether you might be so good perhaps, as to write out, worry large so that anyone could see it anywheres, as that I was worry truly hearty sorry, that I done it, and that I never went fur to do it, and that though I didn't know nothing at all, I knowed as Mr. Woodcott once cried over it, and was allus grieved over it, and that I hoped as he'd be able to forgive me in his mind. If the written could be made to say it worry large, he might. It shall say it, Joe. Very large. Joe laughs again. Thank ye, Mr. Snagsby. It's worry kind of you, sir, and it makes me more comfler nor I was afore. The meek little stationer, with a broken and unfinished cough, slips down his fourth half crown. He has never been so close to a case requiring so many and is fain to depart. And Joe and he, upon this little earth, shall meet no more. No more. For the cart so hard to draw, is near its journey's end and drags over stony ground. All round the clock it labors up the broken steps, shattered and worn. Not many times can the sun rise, and behold it still upon its weary road. Phil Squad, with his smoky gunpowder visage, at once acts as nurse, and works as armorer at his little table in a corner, often looking round and saying with a nod of his green baize cap, and an encouraging elevation of his one eyebrow, hold up, my boy, hold up. there too, is Mr. Jarndyce many a time, and Alan Woodcourt almost always, both thinking, much, how strangely fate has entangled this rough outcast in the web of very different lives. There too, the trooper is a frequent visitor, filling the doorway with his athletic figure, and, from his superfluity of life and strength, seeming to shed down temporary vigor upon Joe, who never fails to speak more robustly in answer to his cheerful words. Joe is in a sleeper in a stupor today, and Alan Woodcourt, newly arrived, stands by him, looking down upon his wasted form. After a while he softly seats himself upon the bedside with his face towards him just as he sat in the law writer's room, and touches his chest and heart. The cart had very nearly given up, but labors on a little more. The trooper stands in the doorway, still and silent. Phil has stopped in a low clinking noise, with his little hammer in his hand. Mr. Woodcourt looks round with that grave professional interest and attention on his face, and glancing significantly at the trooper, signs to Phil to carry his table out. When the little hammer is next used, there will be a speck of rust upon it. Well, Joe, what is the matter? Don't be frightened. I thought, says Joe, who has started, and is looking round, I thought I was in Tom All Alone's a gin. Ain't there nobody here but you, Mr. Woodcourt? Nobody. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.